Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It has been a tumultuous start to the new decade, with headlines including the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's firing of ballistic missiles, the deadly crash of a Ukrainian jetliner, and of course, ongoing developments in the impeachment trial of President Trump. We thought we'd take a close look at these issues with U.S. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. He sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and is in studio with us this morning. Good to have you with us again.
Great to be back with you.
All right. And as always, the number to call in is 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Senator Coons, let's get started with the impeachment trial. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of course, has delayed sending the articles of impeachment over, but has indicated she's likely going to do so this week. And so the trial of President Trump in the Senate could actually get underway this week. And my understanding is it is likely to look very much like that of President Bill Clinton back in 1999. Is that your understanding as well?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the question over witnesses and new documents. Democratic leaders, of course, in the Senate say they should be allowed. We also have several GOP senators, including Susan Collins and Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski, who are in agreement and I think are actively working to try to get this piece of the trial, this included into the trial. Again, tell us what the necessity is.
So broadly speaking, witnesses have trials. Yeah. Cover-ups don't.
Yeah.
There are several individuals who've said they are willing to come forward and testify. There's been evidence that's come forward or been developed in the last couple of weeks since the House voted out two articles of impeachment, both a suggestion that there are emails that were not previously disclosed that would be relevant, and a list of four witnesses that Senator Schumer, Minority Leader Schumer, put forward several weeks ago now, saying here are four individuals, and Secretary Pompeo and former National Security Advisor John Bolton are the best known of those four. These are four individuals who were in the room, who were on the emails, who could give in-person, relevant, timely testimony to what President Trump did or didn't do. President Trump several weeks ago was saying, oh, of course, I think they should testify. Now this weekend he was saying, well, no, absolutely not. I need to protect the institution of the presidency. Let me speak to that briefly, if I might. Executive privilege doesn't create a get out of appearing free card. It is a privilege that exists and has been exerted by previous presidents. But if the president is trying to clear his reputation through the Senate trial, why wouldn't he want a former national security advisor who is volunteering to testify to appear? Why wouldn't he want a trial in which folks who were in the room and could testify to what actually happened under oath, which they didn't do in the House, could appear and then help clear his name? So I've had that conversation with a number of colleagues. President Trump seems to be very eager to be, quote unquote, exonerated in the Senate. That only happens when you have a full and fair trial. President Clinton and President Nixon directed their closest advisors and senior cabinet officials to cooperate with impeachment inquiries. President Trump directed all of them not to. Several senior administration officials appeared and testified in front of the House Intelligence Committee over the objections of the administration. There were two impeachment articles voted out of the House. The second article has to do with obstruction of Congress because Trump refused to allow relevant witnesses to testify and relevant documents to be produced. So if folks are following this closely, what will likely happen this week is mostly the preparation for a trial.
Sure.
The period when we get impaneled as the equivalent of a jury where the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will come, the House managers will come over, they will present the articles. But then there's a several-day-long period for the president to prepare and deliver his briefs explaining his defense, and then for the House managers to reply. This is what happens in a typical criminal trial. After the indictment is presented, there's a period for the attorneys for both sides to present briefs. So we probably will not be sitting as a Senate hearing the arguments of the House managers for another full week.
Okay. Characterize the relevance of this trial should there be no witnesses.
Well, given that the president blocked the most critical witnesses from testifying in front of the House, it will be hard for us to have a fair and open trial. The House worked very hard to develop a detailed accounting of what happened in the administration. Just to remind your listeners, President Trump's accused of having conducted a shakedown of a close allied country of Ukraine, which has been under pressure for years from separatists who are trained and funded by the Russians. And he dangled $400 million in congressionally appropriated military assistance to Ukraine on the condition that they do him a favor of opening an investigation without foundation into his strongest potential rival in the 2020 campaign, former Vice President Joe Biden. That's really a fairly striking abuse of power, if true. And it is the first time that there's been a president impeached over an abuse of office that involved national security and foreign policy conduct of this type. And part of the pressure that I believe the House managers felt to proceed, even when they weren't able to compel the testimony of key witnesses, was that what the president's accused of doing is interfering in our 2020 election, which is now just a few months away.
You expressed concern. You have expressed concern about the fallout should there be an acquittal in the Senate that the president will be, quote, unbounded. What does that mean?
Well, the constitutional remedy for a president abusing his power or acting outside of his scope of authority is impeachment, ultimately. That's what the Constitution provides. President Trump, after this impeachment inquiry began, walked out on the front drive of the White House and challenged China to do what they could to dig up dirt on his political rival. I'll remind you that candidate Trump in 2016 famously said at a rally, "Russia, if you're listening, see if you can find Hillary Clinton's emails." And evidence shows that it was literally that day that Russian military intelligence began attempting to hack into Hillary Clinton's email server. So the idea that we have a president who is so either callous to or cavalier about foreign interference in our elections is fairly disturbing to me. And if he believes it will help him win the election and he believes that he's been cleared or exonerated in the Senate because an impeachment trial results in a straight line party vote and he is not convicted, not removed, I'm gravely concerned that our 2020 election is at real risk.
Chris Coons, are you concerned the impeachment process might come back to hurt Democrats in swing districts this election year?
Well, the recent polls in states where there are closely contested Senate races show that the overwhelming majority of Americans want a fair trial, and that includes wanting to see relevant witnesses and testimony. Impeachment has been a very contentious issue. Folks who are loyal Trump supporters strongly oppose impeachment, and I've heard from quite a few of them in Delaware. A broader range of citizens in Delaware strongly support the impeachment, and I've heard from even more of those. So I get regular input from Delawareans, and it's running about 60-40 in favor of impeachment, the emails and letters and phone calls to my office. But it's not 90-10.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it were to affect Democrats in a negative way in the fall, it will still have been worth it, I'm assuming. I'm putting words into your mouth, but it could be devastating.
I'll remind you that Speaker Pelosi resisted calls for an impeachment inquiry for months from some elements of her caucus in the House. And it was only once President Trump's effort with regards to Ukraine was exposed by a whistleblower and then confirmed that she began saying it's time for an impeachment inquiry. We have to. It is our constitutional obligation. So I don't think Speaker Pelosi either took this on as a partisan gambit or took any joy in this. I think she saw it really as her solemn obligation under the Constitution to begin the inquiry.
The death of Qasem Soleimani just over a week ago. Is the world, are Americans safer with him dead?
Well, there's no doubt that Qasem Soleimani and the Quds Force, which he commanded, was Iran's most lethal military arm. And General Soleimani's role in organizing, funding, directing, inspiring their network of proxies around the region, from Hezbollah to Hamas to the Houthis in Yemen, made him a quite effective and lethal leader. He's tied to attacks on American troops that may have killed as many as 600 Americans in the war in Iraq, as well as incidents in Afghanistan. So this is not a good guy. And having Qasem Soleimani gone from this earth is, I think, undeniably a good thing for the United States and our interests. But to get a full accounting of what this means, you have to look at the consequences. I don't believe that Iran is done with their retaliation or counterattack. I think their next step may well happen in a time and place that we have difficulty predicting or defending against.
Cyberspace is a big fear.
They are a particularly able actor. They're a particularly capable cyber actor. They also have this network of proxies, not just in the immediate region, but of also agents throughout the world. They have carried out lethal attacks in countries as diverse as Bulgaria and Argentina over the last 20 years. So first, I don't think we've seen the last of this. Second, General Soleimani may achieve in his death what he couldn't achieve in his life, which was one of his principal goals, was getting the United States expelled from Iraq to create a broader range of operation for Iran in Iraq. And as you saw, the vote of the parliament and the statement by the prime minister suggest that Iraq is moving towards expelling all American troops. That would harm our work against ISIS. It would leave Iraq much more heavily under the influence of Iran. And I think in terms of our immediate short-term regional goals, would be harmful. So,
well, then was the timing, in your opinion, of the killing of Soleimani not correct, not right?
Well, there's two components to that, I think. You know, there was reporting today by NBC that President Trump had authorized the killing of Soleimani months ago. And we had a very contentious classified briefing last week that lasted just over an hour. It was about 75 minutes, where 100 senators were present and the whole senior national security team from the administration came. And they gave us very little in the way of details, virtually nothing, other than asserting that they had credible intelligence that there was an imminent threat. President Trump told Laura Ingraham on Fox on cable more than he told the Senate. There was no mention of there being a credible specific threat to bomb four embassies, for example, something which his own Secretary of Defense, Secretary Esper, in an interview over this past weekend also said he hadn't really heard.
So it's really tough to determine whether this killing was timely.
Timely,
that's what I'm hearing.
If what you're really asking me is,
in terms of whether there was a specific threat.
Was there an imminent threat that
mm-hmm.
the president in his commander-in-chief role has the authority to act? Correct. I think that's very debatable. The real issue that I tried to raise in that briefing, and I've now has been reported, and so I'm now speaking to, is, look, there's a spectrum, there's a continuum of events. Let's say the president gets credible intelligence that there really is an imminent threat to American diplomats or troops overseas at an American base. Yes, as Commander-in-Chief, Article 2 of the Constitution, he has the power and the authority, even the responsibility, to act to protect Americans overseas. But in a fact pattern that is very slow evolving, where it is entirely predictable months in advance that actions that the president and his national security team are taking may well lead to war, of course, I said, you have to agree that you would have to come seek authorization from Congress. And the refusal to agree to that was what produced bipartisan uproar in that briefing and the abrupt ending of the briefing. Mm-hmm. If we know right now that President Trump has said publicly Iran will not have a nuclear weapon while I'm president, and as a result of this strike on Soleimani and other developments, our leaving the Iran deal, Iran's leadership has now said they're going to abandon restraints on their enrichment. They're going to renew nuclear enrichment. It's pretty predictable that at some point in the next 6 months to a year, the national security team will come to the president and say, Iran is close to reaching a threshold where we have to take action. My point, privately and now publicly, is you have to seek authorization from Congress for that kind of action. We're a democracy. We have to have a debate about this. We can't just march to a new forever war in the Middle East without the public being engaged.
So let's get to the War Powers Resolution, which was approved by the House last week, which would aim to limit President Trump's military actions against Iran. There would need to be authorization from Congress. Is there enough support to get this through the Senate?
I'm a co-sponsor of Senator Tim Kaine's resolution in the Senate. I think it will get through just narrowly. I think it'll get 51-52 votes. The administration is lobbying very hard against it. That would send it to the president's desk, but he will veto it. And I don't think there's a chance we'll get enough Republican support for it to survive a veto. I'm not trying to weaken our troops in the field. I'm trying to demonstrate the power of a democracy, which is that we actually should have a debate about these things before launching into another conflict. And that also means members of Congress have to be responsible and accountable for being engaged and for putting forward what we believe would be a strategy that would keep us safer and make us a more responsible actor in the region and the world.
You are co-sponsoring legislation to provide nearly $3.5 billion in aid annually to Israel. Republican Senator Marco Rubio is partnering with you on this. Why now?
There was a MOU signed between the Obama administration and the government of Israel. This is simply authorizing that MOU. So our current appropriations are at this level. They have been for several years following the Obama-Netanyahu MOU. But I think it's important that Congress authorize it, that we actually have a vote on the floor of the Senate saying we are aware of and support this level of security cooperation between the United States and Israel.
What are we hearing from Israel about the crisis in Iran?
I personally have heard nothing in the last week, but I would expect that our administration and their administration are coordinating regularly. I'll remind you, Prime Minister Netanyahu is in a uncertain period. He is the subject of criminal investigations by their attorney general, and I believe is facing an indictment and is asking the Knesset to enact a law that would shield him from that. And there's upcoming elections, I think, the 3rd of March.
The White House is considering expanding its travel ban to additional countries. And so tell us about the No Ban Act, which you are co-sponsoring.
So the No Ban Act is a bipartisan, excuse me, it is not a bipartisan attempt. It is a Democrats-only attempt at enacting a statute in Congress that would amend our underlying immigration laws in a way that would invalidate the Supreme Court's opinion that upheld the third version of President Trump's travel ban. I'll remind you, as candidate Trump, President Trump said that he would ban Muslims from coming to our country. One of his first executive orders early in 2011 as president enacted a travel ban on countries, on individuals coming from majority Muslim countries. That was invalidated by a court. He took a second try. That was invalidated by a court. He took a third try. That one was ultimately upheld by the Supreme Court because it contained within it an exemption process or a way that you could apply and seek a waiver. That waiver process, in reality, has been a complete fiction. There are thousands of American citizen families divided where there is a husband and a spouse, a parent and a child, an ailing grandparent who are stuck in countries from Yemen to Iran because of this travel ban.
And very quickly, we only have a couple seconds left. Where is the No Ban Act in the congressional process?
It's in the House. I am hoping it has had a hearing. I am hoping it will have a markup and a vote on the floor. This is building support for a bill that I hope could become law in the next Congress.
U.S. Senator Chris Coons, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we learn about one of the oldest forms of American music, sacred harp singing. Keep it here.